Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Whenever we approach the canonical texts of our tradition, there is an underlying assumption.
A sort of bias, really.
Yeah, exactly. An unconscious bias that the trajectory of the Dharma is always one of gradual loosening. We're trained to view the path as this progressive release of our grasping.
Right. A systematic dismantling of all the attachments that bind us to samsara.
Exactly. I mean, we are taught to view the aggregates as empty, to see wealth as illusory, and, you know, even our own physical bodies as these temporary biological vessels, just rented for a brief span of decades. So the expected atmosphere of a profound teaching is usually one of serene, weightless detachment.
It is the prevailing narrative, certainly. Oh. We often conflate the realization of shunyata with a kind of passive floating.
Yeah.
Assuming that spiritual maturity just means holding nothing tightly.
Yet when we confront certain foundational Mahayana scriptures, that expectation is violently upended. The atmosphere completely shifts from a gentle unburdening to, well, an environment of fierce, uncompromising architectural tension.
It really does. The Buddha points to specific structural elements of the path and commands the assembly to grip them with an intensity that seems, at first glance, totally contrary to the doctrine of non-attachment.
He tells us, basically, hold on to this. Never let this go.
The paradox is striking. The practitioner is commanded to abandon all worldly clinging while simultaneously being handed an entirely new set of absolute anchors.
Today, we are opening a space to examine one of those ultimate anchors. And this is a teaching that does not ask for casual participation from you, the listener.
No, it demands a level of existential commitment that challenges our very biological imperative to survive.
We are examining the noble Mahayana Sotra on the four factors. It's cataloged in the Tibetan canon as Ta 251, utilizing the brilliant translation from the Deje Kangyur by the 84,000 Project. But before we touch the doctrine itself, we must ground ourselves in the spatial and historical reality of the text.
That's crucial.
Imagine traveling back over two millennia to ancient India, specifically to the city of Srivasti. We are entering Jetta's Grove, a Nathapita's park.
And Jetta's Grove cannot be treated as mere atmospheric prologue. I mean, for anyone studying the early history of the Achanga, this specific location represents a monumental tectonic shift in spiritual technology.
Because before this, they were wanderers, right?
Exactly. Prior to the establishment of this grove, the early Buddhist community consisted almost entirely of wandering ascetics. They were peripatetic, moving constantly, relying entirely on alms.
Right.
Jetta's Groves, which was purchased through the staggering patronage of the merchant Anathapi Huda, changed that dynamic. It was a place where the monks were first formally housed during the torrential, impassable rains of the monsoon season.
Which effectively makes it the prototype for the Buddhist monastic institution. It transitioned the Soenga from a decentralized movement into a settled pedagogical community.
Furthermore, it became the great incubator. Because the community was settled there for months at a time, it provided the stable environment necessary for the Buddha to deliver his most complex, sustained discourses.
And the assembly gathered for this particular discourse is vast. The Sotra notes that Shakyamuni Buddha is residing there alongside 1,250 monks.
Plus a great, measureless assembly of Bodhisu Ichivas.
We really have to pause and consider the sheer spiritual gravity of that gathering. We're talking about thousands of highly realized practitioners, individuals who have already shattered the illusion of a solid self, sitting in complete stillness beneath the trees.
When an assembly of that magnitude is convened, the teaching delivered is invariably structural. It's foundational.
And the historical pedigree of this specific Sotra proves that later generations recognized its foundational nature. Its transmission history is a testament to how highly it was prioritized.
Yeah, we are not looking at a fringe text here. We know from an annotated manuscript discovered in the walled-up library of the Dunhuang Caves.
Oh, the manuscript designated as IOL Tibj 69, right?
That's the one. We know from that manuscript that this text was translated into Tibetan during the very first great wave of Dharma transmission. It was translated by the brilliant Indian preceptor Surendra Bodhi and the prolific Tibetan translator Yeshe Day.
That places it right in the crucible of the Tibetan Empire's early 9th century intellectual explosion.
It does. And we know the Tibetan translation was finalized by the early 9th century because the Esso Otra is explicitly listed in both the Dhenkarma and the Fangthanma catalogs.
Right, the oldest imperially sponsored catalog.
Exactly, created to standardize the language of awakening. But the transmission wasn't limited to the Himalayas. It was simultaneously moving eastward along the Silk Road.
We have the Chinese translations too.
Yes, two separate complete Chinese translations preserved in the Taishu Tripitaka. Both meticulously completed by the master Devakara during the Tang Dynasty around 680 and 601 CE.
The cross-continental effort to preserve this text speaks of volumes. It's also situated within a very deliberate pedagogical framework within the canon itself. In the Dage Kangyur, this Esso Otra belongs to a specific cluster of five texts that all organize their instructions into sets of four.
Right, like the Esso Otra teaching the four factors, which deals with confession. The numerical categorization, the reliance on sets of four, is a classic element of ancient Indian mnemonic technology.
But it's more than just a memory trick.
Much more. Grouping profound truths into a tetrad creates a mandala of practice. It gives the mind four distinct walls to construct an indestructible philosophical fortress.
Which brings us to the core thesis of the Buddha's address. Yeah. He looks out over this vast assembly and he establishes a premise that completely shatters any lingering complacency.
He does.
He declares that there are four specific factors of the path that a bodhisattva must never abandon. And the metric he uses for this commitment is absolute. He states they must not abandon these four factors even at the cost of their lives.
Even at the cost of their lives. It's an instruction that pierces the veil of comfortable, intellectualized spirituality.
I have to interject here and push back on the sheer practicality of this standard, because this is where the philosophy seems to conflict with the mechanics of practice.
How so?
Well, in our tradition, the precious human rebirth is constantly emphasized. We're taught that obtaining a human vessel to hear and practice the Dharma is rarer than a blind turtle surfacing its head through a single yoke on a vast ocean.
Yes, a classic analogy.
Right. Our physical life is the very vehicle of our liberation. So isn't throwing away this incredibly rare biological vehicle for the sake of a rigid set of vows a fundamental contradiction? Why burn the boat while you are still trying to cross the river of Sameswa?
That's a valid question. But the contradiction only exists if we view the physical body and the continuum of the vow as possessing equal ontological weight. The Buddha is forcing the assembly to recalibrate their understanding of what constitutes true survival.
Okay, unpack that a bit.
Yes, the human rebirth is agonizingly rare and precious, but it is still fundamentally impermanent. No matter how fiercely you guard the physical vessel, it will inevitably deteriorate and die. The body is just a temporary, localized phenomenon.
Right.
The bodhisattva vow, however, is a multiversal continuum. If you compromise the four factors to extend the biological lifespan of one temporary body for a few more decades, you sever the karmic trajectory that spans thousands of lifetimes.
I see. So the death of the physical body is merely a biological transition, whereas the abandonment of the vow is basically spiritual suicide.
It is the destruction of the architecture of awakening itself. To prioritize the physical body over the factors of awakening is to act out of the very self-cherishing ignorance that keeps us trapped in samsara.
He's demanding that we identify entirely with our awakened aspiration rather than our biological survival instinct.
Exactly.
That reframing sets a terrifyingly high bar. Let's dismantle the first of these four non-negotiable factors, the internal seed from which everything else must grow.
The foundation.
The text states these instructions are directed at bodhisattvas. And assuming we all understand the baseline definition of a bodhisattva as one who delays their own final nirvijeshna to liberate all sentient beings, the Buddha delivers his first imperative.
Which is?
Monks, for as long as they live, bodhisattvas, great beings, should not abandon the thought of awakening even at the cost of their lives. The thought of awakening, the bodhicitta.
The term thought of awakening barely scratches the surface of the Sanskrit bodhicitta. Since we are dealing with advanced mechanics here, we must bypass the elementary definitions and look at the profound structural tension inherent in the concept.
The traditional commentaries divide bodhicitta into two inextricably linked aspects, right?
Yes, the relative and the absolute. And maintaining the friction between these two is the highest art of the Mahayana practitioner.
Let's examine that friction. The relative aspect is the active, unwavering aspiration to achieve complete Buddhahood, specifically for the liberation of others. It's coupled with the rigorous application of the Paramitas, generosity, discipline, patience, and so on.
It is the vows taken, the rituals performed, the physical energy expended to pull beings out of suffering.
And the absolute aspect is the direct, non-conceptual realization of shunyata. It's the profound recognition that all phenomena, including the suffering beings you are vowing to save, are completely devoid of inherent independent existence.
Right. Absolute bodhicitta is the mind resting in the unelaborated nature of reality, completely free from all dualistic constructs.
This is where the practitioner faces a tremendous cognitive challenge. I mean, how does one simultaneously maintain a fierce, localized vow to save suffering entities while resting in the absolute knowledge that neither the savior nor the saved possess solid reality?
It's the ultimate tightrope walk.
Let me offer an image to see if it clarifies this dynamic. Think of reality as a complex holographic projection. Relative bodhicitta is the intricate, beautiful light interacting with the world. It has color. It engages with the tears and the pain of the world.
Beautiful.
But absolute bodhicitta is the simultaneous realization that the light has no solid mass.
That perfectly captures the necessity of their integration. If we separate them, the path collapses into two distinct fatal extremes.
What happens if we only rely on the relative?
If a practitioner relies purely on relative bodhicitta, if they see the suffering of the world as solid, inherent, and material, they will inevitably be crushed by the sheer mathematics of samsara.
They'll just burn out.
Exactly. They will look at the infinite number of beings experiencing infinite variations of agony and succumb to compassion fatigue. Lifting a world that you believe to be solid requires an infinite amount of material energy.
The weight of solid suffering becomes unbearable, but the opposite extreme is equally disastrous.
Perhaps even more so. If the practitioner realizes absolute shunyata, seeing all phenomena as illusions or mirages, but lacks the warmth of relative compassion, they fall into nihilism.
They might rationalize, since the suffering is ultimately an illusion, there's no need for me to intervene.
Precisely. I will simply rest in my own unconditioned realization. This is the subtle trap of the solitary realizer, the arhat extreme, which the Mahayana views as a premature halting of the spiritual journey.
The two aspects must perfectly cross-pollinate. The realization of emptiness keeps the compassion from becoming heavy and exhausting, allowing you to work tirelessly for eons.
And meanwhile, the burning relative compassion prevents the realization of emptiness from freezing into cold, indifferent detachment.
This unified, synthesized bodhicitta is the very DNA of a Buddha. Therefore, the Buddha at Jetta Grove commands that it cannot be abandoned, even if a sword is at your neck.
Because if you renounce this unified vision to protect your physical form, you have traded the infinite architecture of universal liberation for a few more breaths of a dying animal. You've lost the thread of your own eternal nature.
Understanding that the internal compass of bodhicitta must be defended with one's life, we have to acknowledge a practical reality. Having a compass doesn't automatically mean you know how to navigate the hostile terrain of samsara.
We suffer from profound spiritual amnesia.
We do. Our internal realization is frequently obscured by lifetimes of ingrained karmic habits. This requires an external intervention, leading directly to the second factor.
The Buddha says, monks, for as long as they live, bodhisattvas, great beings, should not abandon the spiritual friend even at the cost of their lives.
The spiritual friend, the Kalyanamitra in Tibetan, the Jajbai Bhusha Zen. And we must strip away any modern colloquial connotations of the word friend here.
Oh, absolutely. In this context, it does not mean a peer who offers comforting validation over coffee.
No, the text specifically defines the Kalyanamitra as a companion and absolute guide in virtue. This is the master, the realized teacher, the living embodiment of the lineage.
And the historical resonance of this specific line cannot be overstated. When the greatest scholastic minds of India and Tibet needed scriptural authority to prove the absolute necessity of relying on a teacher, they invariably return to this exact sentence.
We see the great Indian master Shantideva utilize it powerfully in his compendium of training, right?
Yes. And why did Shantideva choose this specific esotra? He was addressing the monks at Nalanda University, who were arguably the most sophisticated intellectuals on the planet at the time.
And high-level scholasticism often breeds a subtle arrogance.
Exactly. The belief that ultimate reality can be reverse-engineered purely through debate, reading, and conceptual analysis. Shantideva invoked this esotra to remind the Nalanda scholars that intellect without the direct, abrasive friction of a relationship with the realized master is a dead end.
It's an instruction that cuts across all temporal boundaries. But let me challenge the fundamental architecture of this requirement.
Please do.
If we establish that our Buddha nature is inherently present within all beings and that the ultimate truth is emptiness, why is an external, localized human being elevated to a life or death necessity? Isn't there a risk that equating obedience to an external teacher with the preservation of the path is just an endorsement of institutional power dynamics?
That is a crucial modern objection.
Yeah.
But it misunderstands the mechanics of self-deception within Samsesra. Yes, the Buddha nature is inherently yours, but the ego structure that currently dominates your perception is a master of mimicry.
It's a shapeshifter.
It is. Left to its own devices, the ego will co-opt your meditation, your scriptural study, and even your compassion, transforming them into tools for spiritual materialism. The ego will convince you that you are making progress while subtly fortifying its own defenses.
It builds a very comfortable, holy-sounding echo chamber.
The Kalyanamitra is the one variable in your reality that your ego cannot control or predict. The true spiritual friend doesn't exist to consolidate institutional power. They exist to act as a flawless karmic mirror.
They shatter the echo chamber.
Exactly. They apply pressure exactly where your attachments are most deeply hidden. To abandon the spiritual friend because their guidance threatens your self-image, or because remaining loyal to them endangers your worldly security, is to intentionally close the only window that lets light into your darkened room.
So to abandon the spiritual friend is to consciously choose the comfort of your own delusions over the painful reality of awakening.
It is the ultimate act of spiritual cowardice. If you sever your connection to save your biological life, your body survives, but it becomes a hollow shell wandering endlessly, completely disconnected from the lineage of liberation.
So we have established the internal compass of bodhicitta and the external calibration of the Kalyanamitra, but the practitioner doesn't exist in a vacuum. Guided by the teacher, the bodhisushtiva must actively engage with the world.
And the world is completely capable of manifesting violence.
Exactly. This brings us to the crucible of the path. How do you interface with a hostile world without corrupting your bodhicitta? The Buddha delivers the third factor. Monks, for as long as they live, bodhisattvas, great beings, should not abandon tolerance and lenience even at the cost of their lives.
Tolerance and lenience. It's vital to recognize that while our English translation uses two distinct words representing two distinct Sanskrit terms, santi and saracha, the esotra structurally binds them together as a single inseparable unit.
They are two halves of a single mechanism of engagement.
Yes. To truly dissect this pairing, we have to look at the tenjur and the brilliant sub-commentary provided by the Indian master Janadatta. He doesn't just define the words. He explains exactly how these two forces operate within the psychophysical complex.
Let's begin with tolerance, Ksanti.
Janadatta defines skindhi as the internal capacity to bear the harm inflicted by others. We must be very careful not to confuse this with the psychological suppression of anger.
Right, because when an ordinary person is insulted or physically assaulted, the immediate response is rage, a defensive flare to protect me and mine.
Ksanti is the profound internal spaciousness, born directly from the realization of emptiness, that allows the harm to enter the practitioner's sphere without ever generating the spark of anger in the first place.
Because if you truly realize shunyata, you recognize there is no inherently existing solid self for the harm to actually strike.
Exactly. The arrow of harm flies through empty space. Ksanti is the ultimate internal shock absorber. But the Mahayana path requires more than just internal absorption. This brings us to the second half. Lenience. Saracha.
Janadatta defines lenience as the act of restraint from harming others in return. If tolerance is the internal cessation of anger, lenience is the external cessation of retaliation.
It is the absolute refusal to transmit violence back into the network of Samsara.
And the necessity of binding these two concepts together becomes glaringly obvious when we explore the pathology of separating them. What happens if a practitioner attempts to cultivate lenience without tolerance?
They refrain from retaliating outwardly, Perhaps they even smile and speak gently to their abuser, but internally, their mind is boiling with suppressed rage. They are nursing grievances.
Which is nothing more than a trauma response, really. A form of cowardly avoidance masquerading as spiritual high ground. The internal resentment will eventually rot their spiritual foundation.
Conversely, consider tolerance without lenience. A practitioner might develop a cold Machiavellian endurance. They absorb the blow without emotional reactivity, but they still carefully calculate a strategic retaliation to destroy their opponent later.
That cold retaliation still generates immense negative karma.
Only when Santi and Sriracha are fused together does the practitioner become an impenetrable fortress of compassion. They absorb the hostility and dissolve it completely, refusing to pass the contagion of violence further down the line.
Let me push this to its absolute logical extreme, because the Buddha insists this applies even at the cost of their lives. Let's say a warlord attacks a monastery. The monks are commanded to maintain absolute tolerance and lenience. Doesn't this instruction essentially guarantee the physical destruction of the Somega?
It's a brutal question.
Isn't there a place for striking back to protect the innocent or to preserve the institutions of the Dharma?
That is the most difficult ethical terrain of the Bodhisushtiva path. While advanced teachings do discuss wrathful compassion, in the context of this esotra, the karmic mathematics are uncompromising. We must look at this through the lens of pratitasamutpada-dependent origination.
How does that apply to an attacker?
When an attacker attempts to kill the Bodhisushtiva recognizes that the attacker is acting out of profound ignorance, planting seeds that will guarantee them eons of horrific suffering in the lower realms.
The attacker is essentially destroying their own future.
Yes. If the Bodhisattva retaliates with lethal force, even to protect their own life, they enter into the cycle of karmic violence. They abandon their vow to cherish all beings, because in that moment, the attacker is reduced to an enemy that must be destroyed.
But if they don't retaliate?
If the Bodhisattva maintains flawless tolerance and lenience, even as they are killed, something miraculous happens. They die with a mind bathed in absolute compassion for their murderer. They absorb the ultimate physical defeat, but their spiritual continuum remains unbroken.
They utilize the moment of their execution to perfect their practice of the P.A.Sramitas,
transforming a worldly tragedy into an ultimate spiritual triumph.
The sheer psychological fortitude required to execute that, to override the most basic lizard brain survival instinct and replace it with universal compassion while under lethal threat, is almost incomprehensible. Human endurance has limits. Constantly absorbing the chaotic hostility of the world will inevitably deplete the practitioner.
Which is why the Buddha provides the fourth factor, a method to replenish that internal well.
Monks, for as long as they live, bodhisattvas, great beings, should not abandon dwelling in the wilderness even at the cost of their lives.
Dwelling in the wilderness. To understand this, we must first look at the literal external application, and then drill down into the profound psychological methodology hidden in the Sanskrit terminology.
Externally, this refers to aranavasa, right?
Yes. It's listed among the traditional ascetic practices. It mandates physically departing from the social, economic, and political entanglement of the town or village.
The great Indian master Vimalamitra heavily emphasized this. He argued that to stabilize the mind in Shah M.A.H. Ta calm abiding, one must physically step away from the endless noise of society. You can't hear the subtle whispers of your own mind if you are standing in a crowded marketplace.
But the physical relocation is merely the superficial layer of the instruction. The translation notes illuminate a spectacular linguistic mechanism at play here. The Sanskrit term for dwelling in the wilderness is aranavasa, but this word is conceptually wedded to a nearly identical term, arana.
And arana completely redefines the practice.
It does. Arana translates literally as free from afflictions. It denotes a state entirely devoid of the disturbing, neurotically driven emotions like attachment, aversion, jealousy, and fundamental ignorance.
So the Buddha is delivering a dual instruction embedded within a single concept. There is the outer wilderness and the inner wilderness.
Precisely.
Let me try a new analogy to conceptualize this, moving away from the tired cliche of the quiet forest pond.
Let's hear it.
Imagine the ordinary human mind is a worker operating inside a deafeningly loud, incredibly dangerous manufacturing plant. The massive machines of samsayaj, raw gossip, political outrage, economic anxiety, interpersonal drama are constantly roaring.
A very modern, accurate picture.
The outer wilderness, aranyavasa, is the act of physically walking out the doors of the factory to get away from the noise. But if you walk out into the forest, sit down, and spend the next 10 hours obsessively replaying the arguments you had with your coworkers, you haven't actually left the factory.
The noise is still deafening. Your physical coordinates have changed, but your psychological reality is still deeply embedded in the industrial machinery of suffering.
Exactly. The inner wilderness, Arana, is the construction of a perfect psychological acoustic seal. It's a soundproof room built within the mind itself. When you achieve Arana, your mind is completely insulated from the afflictions.
And the profound reality is that once you build that perfect acoustic seal in the quiet of the forest, you can eventually walk right back onto the factory floor.
You can stand in the middle of the deafening machinery of the city, yet remain in perfect, serene silence because the sanctuary is entirely internal.
That is the ultimate goal of the Mahayajna practitioner. The physical isolation of the forest is merely a temporary training ground to construct that internal acoustic seal.
So when the Buddha commands the Bodhisattvas to not abandon dwelling in the wilderness even at the cost of their lives, he's not simply telling them to fiercely defend a specific piece of real estate in the mountains.
No, he is commanding them to defend their unafflicted state of mind with their very lives. If the world attempts to drag you back into the chaos of hatred or greed, even by threatening your life, you must refuse to let the worldly winds breach your internal seal.
We now have this massive architectural framework laid out by the Buddha, the internal seed of bodhicitta, the external calibration of the spiritual friend, the impenetrable armor of tolerance and lenience, the acoustic seal of the inner wilderness.
A complete ecosystem.
How does the Buddha cement this complex ecosystem into the consciousness of the assembly? He shifts his rhetorical strategy in the text.
The prose section of the Esotra utilizes a highly deliberate liturgical technology. It's built upon the relentless repetition of anaphora, beginning each injunction with monks for as long as they live, and epistrophe concluding each mandate with even at the cost of their lives.
It's not merely a mnemonic device, is it?
Not at all. When you read it aloud or hear it chanted, it functions as an energetic hammer. It rhythmically bypasses the analytical scholastic mind and drives the absolute urgency of the stakes directly into the subconscious.
After striking that gong 6 separate times in the prose, the Buddha transitions into the elevated metric of verse to summarize the entire doctrine. He declares, "Let the wise conceive the thought of perfect awakening and not cast aside the thought of omniscience. Let them maintain the strength of tolerance and lenience and never forsake the spiritual friend."
Notice the sequencing there.
Yes, I want to look at that. In the prose section, the spiritual friend was introduced as the second factor and tolerance and lenience were third. But in the concluding poetic summary, the Buddha shifts the order. He commands the assembly to maintain tolerance and lenience before telling them to never forsake the spiritual friend.
It's a fascinating inversion.
Does that hold philosophical weight, or is it merely the structural demand of the Sanskrit meter?
While metric requirements always play a role in sutric poetry, we can extract a profound practical insight from the inversion. It highlights the deeply symbiotic nature of the factors.
Because you need the spiritual friend to instruct you in the cultivation of tolerance.
Yes, but practically speaking, you absolutely must possess a vast reservoir of tolerance and lenience to endure the rigorous, ego-annihilating training that a genuine spiritual friend will put you through. The master's job is to dismantle your illusions.
Oh, I see. If you lack tolerance, you'll inevitably interpret their guidance as a personal attack and you'll flee.
Exactly. You cannot maintain proximity to the fire of a true teacher without the heat shield of Santi.
I am also fascinated by a textual variation noted by the translators regarding the very first line of the verse. In the Stock Palace Kangyur, which is an alternate, highly respected edition of the canon, the line reads, "Let the wise conceive the bodhisattva rather than conceive the thought of awakening."
That subtle ontological shift is brilliant. It reinforces the absolute non-duality of the path. The thought of awakening bodhicitta is not merely an accessory that a practitioner wears. It is the very substance that transforms an ordinary being into a bodhisattva.
The vow and the entity are completely indistinguishable. You do not merely have bodhicitta. You become bodhicitta.
Yes.
The final stanza introduces imagery that encapsulates the resultant state of this practice. The Buddha concludes, "If the wise, like the king of beasts, abandon fear, always remain dwelling in the wilderness and constantly maintain these factors, they will conquer the Maras and attain awakening."
The king of beasts, the lion.
The lion's roar is a recurring motif in the Dharma. Why does the lion perfectly represent the practitioner who maintains these four factors?
Well, a lion in his natural domain does not adopt a defensive posture.
Yes.
It moves through the wilderness without looking over his shoulder, entirely devoid of the neurotic anxiety that plagues prey animals.
And fear, fundamentally, is rooted in the desperate need to protect the self, the physical body, the reputation, the ego.
Exactly. The Bodhisattva, who has truly integrated these four factors, has completely relinquished self-cherishing. When you have already offered your life, your energy, and your entire karmic continuum to the liberation of others, you have nothing left to protect. You become structurally invulnerable to fear.
What is left to threaten? You cannot intimidate someone who has already factored their own death into their equation of universal compassion, which perfectly explains the ultimate promise of the Esotra. They will conquer the Maras.
We all know the Maras represent the demonic forces, the internal psychological obstacles, the clinging to the physical aggregates, and the terrifying reality of death itself. How does this specific Esotra teach us to defeat them?
Not through magical combat or esoteric ritual.
Right. It defeats them through structural starvation. The Maras can only attack where there is attachment. If a practitioner guards these four factors, if they maintain their bodhicitta, rely entirely on their teacher, absorb all hostility without anger, and dwell in the unafflicted acoustic seal of their own mind, they present a completely smooth surface.
The Maras simply have no handholds. The hooks of samsara slide right off.
Exactly.
That brings us to the profound culmination of the text. The Buddha has delivered a complete self-sustaining architecture for perfect awakening. The seed of intention, the external mirror of the guide, the impenetrable armor against worldly hostility, and the unassailable sanctuary of the quiet mind.
And the Esotra records that upon hearing these words, the monks, the Bodhisattvas, and the entire vast assembly at Jeddah Grove rejoiced and praised the words of the Blessed One.
We must remember that their rejoicing was not merely the polite applause following a good lecture. It was the visceral, overwhelming joy of beings who had just been handed the precise combination to unlock the prison of samsara.
They were given a framework that guaranteed their ultimate triumph over suffering, provided they possessed the courage to uphold it.
As we conclude this Dharma teaching today, the challenge is to bridge the gap between the ancient joy of that assembly and our own modern lives. We sit here millennia later with the same minds facing the same fundamental suffering. The stakes, while perhaps appearing different on the surface, remain absolutely identical.
The Buddha repeated the phrase, even at the cost of their lives, 6 times to ensure we never treat this practice casually.
Today, it is highly unlikely that anyone listening to this will face a literal executioner demanding they renounce their spiritual teacher or their vows. But the absence of a literal sword does not mean we are safe.
In fact, it might make our situation more perilous.
Because the threat doesn't look like a life or death emergency, we allow these factors to slowly, comfortably erode. We trade the pristine acoustic seal of our inner wilderness for the cheap, endless dopamine of digital arguments and outrage.
We abandon our tolerance and lenience daily, choosing the petty validation of sarcasm and righteous revenge over the difficult work of absolving harm.
We ignore the abrasive, necessary guidance of our spiritual friends because it bruises our delicate self-image. The modern Maras do not attack with flaming weapons. They attack with convenience, social standing, and distraction.
The Buddha commands us to defend these four pillars as if our very existence depends on them, because our ultimate existence does.
So the contemplation we leave you with is this. Look at the subtle everyday concessions you make and ask yourself, what would your life look like if, starting today, you began to guard your spiritual friendships, your tolerance, your inner sanctuary, and your vow of universal compassion with the fierce, uncompromising heart of a lion?
And further, consider what happens at the very end of this biological vessel's journey. What if the process of defending these four factors daily is actually the exact training required for conscious dying?
Oh, that's profound.
When the physical body finally dissolves, the only thing that remains is your inner wilderness. If you haven't built that acoustic seal, you'll be swept away by the terrifying winds of dissolution.
Defending the four factors isn't just about how you live. It's the very architecture of how you will face your own death.
Exactly. May you all find the courage of the lion in your practice.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.